This is the Thursday, the 11th of August, 2022. My name is John Nolden. I'm interviewing Steve Collinson on behalf of the Food Museum in Stowmarket. Steve, can I just ask you to introduce yourself and give us your full name and when you were born?
Yeah, I'm Stephen Glenn Collison, known as Steve. I was born 27th of November, 1951.
And whereabouts was that?
At the other end of Vong Lane.
In Pot Row.
In Grimston.
In Grimston.
Pot Row is part of Grimston. I was born at the Grimston end of Vong Lane.
So you were born at home?
Yes.
Okay. And where did you grow up? Did you stay at that end of Vong Lane for many years?
We stayed there until I was six. And then we moved to Pot Row in 1958. And then I lived there, growing up for the rest of my childhood, living there.
Okay. And can you remember what your earliest memory was?
I think probably helping my father plant carrots in our garden. I would have been probably about three, something like that. I think that would be the earliest. They didn't grow very well. The soil isn't very good.
And your dad thought was a keen gardener?
Not really, no. No. I think at the time, I mean, we were living at... It was a council house, and had quite a big garden, and from what I've learned since, they didn't have much money, and it was a case of growing as much as you could of your own to feed yourself. But no, he wasn't a particularly keen gardener. He went through phases of enjoying gardening, but most of the time he was too busy on the cricket field.
So how many of you are in the family? How many siblings did you have living with you in that?
None. I am an only child.
Okay. Okay.
So I never had anyone to argue with.
And what did your parents do for a living? Or what did your father do for a living?
My father was... well, initially... He joined the Fleet Air Arm and he trained as an aircraft engineer. But when he came out of the Fleet Air Arm, he joined his father, my grandfather, who had been a builder, had his own business, but had gone bankrupt during the Depression. And he was a site manager for a building firm. And my father joined him, in fact, helped to build the house that we then lived in. Oh. but then after that, he got a job with the Air Ministry, based at Sculthorpe, which was an American Air Force base. And he then worked for the local authority as a housing manager. So it gradually evolved. But he had his background, in a sense, was the building industry.
And he carried on doing that until retirement.
He died in his early 50s. He was still at work. He was area housing manager. And my mother had worked in basically in an office doing accounts. And when they were married, she first of all was secretary to the headmaster at Dursingham Secondary School, and then did various part-time secretarial jobs.
That's a bit of a journey up to Dursingham from here.
Yes, she used to cycle through to, I think, to Hillington and catch the school bus. That then took her through to Dursingham. But she was originally from West Wales, so she couldn't have been much further from her roots. She was from Pembrokeshire. She worked at the school until I was born, and then she didn't work for many years, but then, as I say, did part-time sort of accounts and that kind of thing.
So she was as a traditional kind of what you call a housewife as such, in yes. terms of looking after the house and raising you. And
that's right, yes.
Until you were a little bit older then.
That's right.
Okay. And what did you do? What have you done for a living, Steve? Tell us your work career.
I was a school teacher.
Okay, so you followed kind of in your mother's yes. footsteps a bit.
And I went away to college in Matlock, which is where Judith and I met. I then came back and got a job at my old school. And I spent my entire career teaching at my old school. Initially teaching geography, which was my degree subject, but then latterly, and for actually for more of my career, teaching maths. And I was also head of careers.
So what ages of children did you teach?
11 to 16. Although I did teach some of the older ones up to GCSE, I didn't ever teach A level.
So where was this school?
In King's Lynn. Okay. In King's Lynn. And then I retired first in 2008, but I continued to work at the school as a careers advisor part-time for another 7 years.
You must have seen some changes through that period of teaching, how people could kind of discipline children.
Mm. Well, initially, when I first started teaching, it was initially still a grammar school, a boys' grammar school, and then 5 years later, it became a mixed comprehensive. So it was very different. But yes, there were a lot of changes. Having said that, the ethos of the school, as it was when I was there as a pupil and first teaching there, remained to a large extent. And people in the town still refer to it to this day as the grammar school, even though it hasn't been a grammar school for over 40 years. It still has on the gates, and that's how a lot of local people still refer to it.
So initially, when you were teaching, it was a boys only.
Yeah.
And then what year did they allow girls to come?
1979, it became mixed, and it was only initially it was only the first year. It worked through gradually. So it wasn't fully comprehensive until, I suppose, the mid-80s, when the last grammar school year group actually left. And that's when it became, I suppose, you noticed significant changes.
How many pupils were at the school? Is it a big school?
Well, when it was a grammar school, about 500. Once it became fully comprehensive, it went up to, at one point, it was round about 1,400 on the same site as it had been when it was 500. Obviously, with a lot of extra building, it wasn't 1,400 for long. It's sort of round about between 1,200 and 1,300 is the sort of average figure.
Did any kids kind of do any pranks on you as a teacher that you can recall?
Yes. I mentioned it in my retirement speech specifically because two of the pupils involved were then there at this retirement day. One of them actually worked in the school, and the other one was the wife of one of my departmental colleagues. And it was a wonderful occasion. It was April Fool's Day. And they were 12 and 13, and they'd obviously got together and planned all this first lesson in the morning, they knew that we took the register, and then I had to take my register quite a long way back to the school office and then come back. So they were always there waiting for quite a long time. And I got back on this particular April Fool's Day and walked into the room, and all the desks, all the tables had been turned round facing the back of the room, away from the blackboard. My desk had been turned round, and my cupboard, which was behind the desk, had been turned round so that you couldn't actually open it because it was against the wall, and they were all just sitting there, absolutely quiet. And it was wonderful, and it really, I just thought, how inventive to actually come up with something like that. And I discovered afterwards that yes, they planned it, and it's been planned for quite a long time. They'd obviously worked out that this was going to be their first lesson on the 1st of April, and they were going to do something. And it was, it was very enjoyable, actually.
Well, it could have been a much worse prank, couldn't it?
Yes, really, it said a lot about the relationship that they felt they had with me, that they could do that, and that I would see it as a, basically what it was meant to be.
Sounds like you enjoyed your career as a teacher, Steve.
Very much so, yes.
It's probably a lot different now up there at the grammar school.
I would not want to be there now. I certainly wouldn't have wanted to be there over the last 2 or 3 years with all the problems. One of my former colleagues actually lives in the farmhouse just up there. The niece of... She's another one who's related to Isaac Elsegood. And I've spoken to her on a few occasions when we've met in the village, and it wasn't easy at all.
Mm. And for the purpose of the tape, the problems mean COVID and
yes.
Yeah, the pandemic.
Yeah. Mm. Very difficult.
Yeah. So a good career, and never tempted to do anything else. What else did you what did you do in your spare time, when you had spare time, particularly in the summers, perhaps, when you had?
In the summer, school. I played a lot of cricket. In the winter, I refereed football for quite a few years, 12, 13 years, until my hips gave up and I couldn't keep up with the players anymore. So it was really sport. And then obviously with family, with children. But that was my hobby, I mean, in a sense. And that was from a very early age. My father was very keen on football and cricket.
Did you used to play with him at all? Or?
Yes, played. Well, I played football with him occasionally. He played until he was well into his 40s. But cricket, he was playing up until the time he died. He was captain of the club, the village club. And yes, we played together for many years.
Just make sure we're not...
Since I was... I think the first time I actually played, I had to step in once when I was about 10, but played regularly from the time I was about 14, 15. And he was Steve as well, so that caused confusion. And that photograph, that painting, is the cricket ground.
So we're looking at a picture at the Grimston Cricket Ground,
yeah,
there.
Although the trees are gone now, the big trees. But otherwise, that is as it is now.
Do you used to have good afternoon teas?
Yes. Most of the time.
The people in the village sort of... Was it a community kind of event?
Not really. It was basically the players took it in turns to organise the teas. over the years, less and less of the players were actually from the village, although there were quite a few who had connections with the village. They may not live there, but certainly one that I played with for many years, he had been brought up in the village, but then lived in King's Lynn. But and another one was married to someone in the village, and you know, it was that kind of link. But it was also a case of, you know, you knew someone. A lot of people I worked with, actually, there was a connection, there was a link with the school, and quite a few of the staff from the school came and played out here.
So going back to your childhood again, when you're not playing cricket, or when you're a young lad, did your parents ever take you on any holidays or anything like that?
Well, we always, every year, we went to Pembrokeshire, because that was, you know, Mum obviously wanted to go back to see her family. So we would, that was our summer holiday. And my mother's sister had they kept a post office and a sort of small supermarket, and they had a caravan at Broadhaven, which was near Haverford West, where Mum was from. So we would often then stay in the caravan. So that was our sort of regular summer holiday.
That must have been a long journey. How did you get there?
By car. It was a long journey. It still is a long journey. I mean, we tried to go about every 18 months, something like that. But yes, it is a long way. I don't recall exactly, but I know on one occasion Mum said it took them 16 hours to get there.
Before a lot of motorways were built.
Yes. It would regularly, funnily enough, it takes almost as long now as it did 60 years ago. The roads may be better, but the traffic is a lot heavier, and you know, the route is different. It's actually longer now, because initially the route was to go through the middle of places like Worcester and Warwick, and you know, which of course you wouldn't ever dream of doing now. So yes, it is a long way.
How long did you spend down there? Was it kind of a short holiday?
It would be probably about 10 days. I think my father would have taken a couple of weeks off work, and then we'd go. And also, my father's sister lived in Manchester, so we would go up there occasionally. That was perhaps for a weekend, which was an opportunity to go and watch Manchester United or Lancashire County Cricket Club.
Yes.
As they lived in Sale, which was on the railway link, where the stop is right outside Old Trafford Cricket Ground. So it was an easy trip just to go in. And my two cousins were very keen, football and cricket as well, so...
You remember what car, out of interest, your dad would have had when you've been going on these journeys?
Had a variety, because of his job, he had to have a car, so he changed his car quite regularly. But the first one, I do remember was, I think it was an Austin 12. What I do remember about it was that we parked in Broadhaven in a hotel car park, which was all overgrown. And when we came back, there was no petrol left. And unbeknown to Dad, when he pulled in to park the car, he'd driven over something that had a nail protruding and had gone through the petrol tank. So that was quite an experience. But that must have been the first one. But one of the and the first sort of reliable car, if you like, he had when he got this job with the local authority was an A30.
An Austin
A30, and we travelled down to Wales in that with all the luggage, which, having seen recently what an A30, how big an A30 is, must have been quite a challenge, really.
No seatbelts back in those days, so a little bit easier.
Of course, yes.
Did you have a roof rack?
I don't remember a roof rack on that car, but we did have a roof rack on later cars. Yes. In the days when all the cars had a sort of like a little trough, didn't they, along each side, so they could fit the roof rack quite easily. Yes, we did. We did have one.
Okay, we touched on a bit earlier about well, you mentioned that you're related to couple of the people that were originally interviewed by Leeds University back in 1957. Can you just explain your relationship with those?
Yes. William Twight was my grandmother's first cousin. His father and her father were brothers. Isaac Elsegood was my grandmother's brother-in-law, so he wasn't a direct relative. Excuse me. Although there is a link between the Elsegood family and the Collison family, so although he wasn't directly related, it was his wife who was the direct relative. But I remember Isaac Elsegood being referred to as Uncle Ike.
And what memories of, or not knowledge do you have of him?
Not really much, but I have vague memories of actually meeting him and speaking to him. My father used to talk about Uncle Ike, and we would probably go and call and see him occasionally because they lived in the village. So I do have a vague memory of him, obviously as an old man, because that he was in his 80s in 1957, while I was only 5 then. So it would be in when I was very young. So memories are a bit.
What about his children at all? Did you meet?
I don't think he had any children, because he and Alice didn't have any children, and she died in her early 40s. My grandmother's version was that she died because she went out without a hat. We think she died of TB, but so then he married again. Well, he would have been then. She was in her mid-40s, so he would have probably been the same. So I don't think he had any children with his second wife.
When you went round to his house as a small child, what do you remember of him, his physique or his voice or what he was wearing?
To be honest, I don't really remember anything. No. I mean, it was interesting listening to the tape, because I had to listen to it 2 or 3 times before I could really understand what he was talking about. I had no knowledge of what job he'd done or anything like that. All I knew about him was he was this sort of person that was referred to often in the family as Uncle Ike. And, as I say, occasionally meeting him. But I have no real memory of him at all.
Do you remember his house?
No.
No. But no. You do. It's interesting that it's kind of stuck in your head that you've met him. So it's made an impression.
Yes.
But the impression's very blurry, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I didn't know where he lived in the village. Margaret told me where he'd lived. I didn't know. I knew he lived in the village, but that was as much as I knew.
So you're related to William Twite?
Yes.
He was again another person interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
How are you related to him?
He was my grandmother's first cousin.
Okay. Any memories of him?
None at all. No, I didn't actually know that there was that I was related until it was the list of names was in the magazine and I saw William Twite and thought, well, this, you know, the chances are he is related. Let's try and find out, didn't we? And then we looked on the, you know, we've got quite a lot of information and we used, as you say, Ancestry, and discovered that he was, his father was a brother to my great-grandfather.
Okay. So did you have much of a strong relationship with your grandparents? Did you spend any time with them? Did your parents send you round to your grandparents?
My grandfather died when I was six, but I do remember him vividly. And my grandmother, well, we lived next door, because when we moved from the other end of the village, that was because we bought a cottage from my grandfather, which was next door to where he lived. It was a cottage that needed an awful lot of renovation. And unfortunately, and I think he was quite keen for us to buy it, partly because he and my grandmother were getting elderly. He was 69, so they were both in their late 60s. So to have us next door was going to be very helpful. So say my aunt lived in Manchester and my father's brother lived in Fakenham. But then unfortunately my grandfather died before we moved down there. So by the time we moved down, my grandmother was on her own, but she lived next door then, until she died 10 years later. So yeah, so she was next door to us.
So this is
all right through my childhood.
So bearing in mind the main factor about these kind of interviews are focusing on dialect. Did your grandmother have any kind of Norfolk dialect? Can you remember at all?
We were talking about this earlier. I wouldn't say so much dialect. There were one or two sort of expressions, but not so much dialect. Her brother did, my Uncle Jim, I would say. But my grandmother, she had a very strong Norfolk accent. But in terms of using dialect words and phrases, she didn't really so much. Maybe, although she'd never lived anywhere other than in the village, she had been a teacher before she was married. So I suspect that any dialect she may have previously used, because she's then teaching children, you become conscious of it, don't you? And you don't use those phrases. I know that I probably my Norfolk accent is stronger now than it was when I was teaching. Because when I was teaching, I was perhaps more conscious of it. Although it did have distinct advantages because I could understand what the children were saying, which staff who'd come in from other parts of the country would struggle sometimes. But no, I don't know that my grandmother, I wouldn't say she used, there were certain phrases. When my cousins were staying with us, if there was any, you know, anybody started to get a little bit sort of
bit naughty,
she'd, "Don't you put your parts on with me, young man." was one of her favourite comments. I mean, I suppose the one phrase that, you know, my father used a lot, and certainly my grandmother did, Uncle Jim did, and I tend to occasionally, is that a rummin? But that's such a common Norfolk phrase, isn't it?
I guess it's common to us, but it may not be going forwards.
Maybe not. I mean, I'm conscious of the fact that I have a Norfolk accent, mainly because other people tell me I have. I don't consciously. I mean, I can do it. I can read broad Norfolk, can't I? And
are you proud of that heritage?
Yes, absolutely. I used to at school when I was teaching, and we had to do assemblies occasionally. And the one that I really loved, I used to do it, not every year, because obviously they would have heard it before, but every so often, because there was when I was at school as a pupil, because I lived in a village and not in the town, we were sort of considered to be country bumpkins. You know, you don't live in the town. And also a lot of the boys were, it was partly boarding, and a lot of them were sons of forces people. So us country bumpkins, you know, we were sort of second class citizens. And to some extent, there was also a feeling that you should move away from Norfolk, because Norfolk is, you know, you need to go to places like Yorkshire and the Birmingham and London and places like that, as Norfolk is sort of. So I was conscious of that, and I used to say to children, you've got to be proud of where you've come from. Be proud of your heritage. And one of the things I used to do to sort of illustrate that, in one of our, I've got some books of sort of Norfolk dialect, and in one of them is the Christmas story written in broad Norfolk. And I used to do that, and I'd just read that story in an assembly. Of course, half of them couldn't understand it. But yes,
they probably didn't know whether to laugh or be serious when they were reading that, did they?
No. No, they didn't. But I think it's important. And also because a lot of staff coming in from other parts of the country, you know, would sort of feel that, where on earth am I coming to, you know, sort of at the edge of the world, you know.
So the mixing of all these people from different parts of the country, that's kind of diluted.
I think it has. I think there's, and but there was almost a sort of, as though children were being told, in order to make anything of yourself, you've got to leave Norfolk, you know, you've got to go away and never come back. And you think, well, actually, it's not.
Have you heard of this phrase that I've heard of, that people often use, that it's the graveyard of ambition, Norfolk? Have you heard of that one?
No, I've not heard that.
It's often used, people, because it's a fine place to live.
Yes.
People end up moving here and then not wanting to move anywhere else.
Well, there's an element of that, I think, as well. I mean, quite a number of teaching colleagues came to Norfolk and stayed for either their entire career, or they didn't, once they got here, they didn't. I mean, one of them actually once said to me, she and her husband had both moved from London and they'd got three children. And she said, we will never move away, until the children are grown up, because this is a much better place to bring up children than being in a big city. And yeah, so I think there is an element of that. A lot of people don't know where it is. I mean, I certainly found that when I went to college in Derbyshire, because most of the students were from Yorkshire, Lancashire, London, and you'd say, where are you from? Norfolk. Where? I got very angry inwardly with my head of department one day, very early on, who was the senior geography lecturer, when she was asking us where we were all from. And when I said Norfolk, she said, "Oh, the Fens." And I wanted to say to her, "The Fens are not in Norfolk, or only just. Most of the Fens are in Lincolnshire and Cambridgeshire." And I thought, "You're a head of geography, you should know that." But
okay, Steve. So one of the other, main purposes of the Food Museum in Stowmarket is food. So can you recall any kind of tasty dishes that your mum or your grandmother might have cooked for you that kind of resonate with you and you maybe carried them forward to now?
Not especially. My mother was not a brilliant cook. My grandmother was an awful cook. My great memory of my grandmother was when my cousins would come to stay with her and she'd be cooking breakfast, she'd announce in the kitchen, "What would you like with your bacon, eggs or grease?" "Oh, grease, Granny, please." Which she was quite pleased about because that was a lot cheaper. No, she was renowned for being an awful cook.
What's grease? Sorry, just the fat.
The fat, yeah. She just sort of spoon it over the bacon. It was very tasty. The one thing I do remember, though, about my grandmother, which has passed down the line, is she was very fond of samphire and used to pickle it. One of my earliest memories of her is seeing her pegging it out on the line to dry.
Where would she buy that from?
Locally, from the Samfer man. He used to come round with a horse and cart. A wonderful story of the Samfer man, who was quite a well-known figure locally. He was, and he used to come round until he was well in his 70s with his horse and cart. And he used to come to where the school was. And one of my colleagues came in one day. He'd gone out to buy some from him. And he was from the Midlands. And he came up to me and he said, "Steve, you will love this. This is pure Norfolk." He said, "I just went out to buy some samphire from Derek." He said, "I said, I'd like a pound of samphire, please." He said, "Do you want a pound in weight or a pound in money?" "Oh, I'll have a pound in weight, please." So he weighed it out, gave it to him. He said, "That'll be a pound." But yes, he would. That would come round. People would go and pick it locally off the marshes at Wolfort and Snetsham. And my daughter, my elder daughter, is very fond of samphire, isn't she? And we used to be able to buy it. One of the houses in Royden, just up the road, would sell it, have a stall outside. They don't do it now, but... So we used to buy it, and elder daughter lives in Torquay, and we used to have to pack it up and send her some every year. So I'd go up to the post office with this parcel. "Can I ask what's in it, please?" "Yeah, oh yes, it's samphire." And they sort of look at you. But yes, that's sort of passed down. But...
It's become really popular now, hasn't it?
Oh, yes. Once people like Rick Stein knew about it, but of course it comes from Cornwall, doesn't it? in all the posh restaurants, you know, if you ask people where Samford comes from, they'll say, oh, it's from Cornwall. And, well, actually, no. Most of it is grown in Norfolk. Yes, it's... but it's, of course, it's now served in all the posh restaurants, isn't it? But not in the way it should be served. Mm. Not just in a bowl of vinegar. To eat with your finger.
tell us how you eat it, yeah.
Oh, how you eat it properly? Yeah. Judith couldn't bear it, could you? It's cooked, put in a bowl of vinegar, and then you take it out in your hand and you hold it up. Drop it into your mouth. Close your mouth, and it all comes off the stalk. That's how it should be served, traditionally, in Norfolk.
Almost like kind of shellfish, idea with vinegar.
Yes.
Would you have it with fish as well, or just on its own?
I would have, I mean, when we had it, we'd just eat it on its own, with perhaps bread and butter or something. I mean, shellfish is actually another of my earliest memories with my grandparents, Winkles, which I did used to eat. My grandmother had a sort of, what would you call them, with sort of pins stuck to it, with all her hat pins. She's got this thing hanging with all her hat pins stuck in it, and that was used for eating, for... if you had winkles on a Sunday.
Pick the winkle out of its shell.
Pick the winkle out of the shell and put it in your mouth, yeah. But that was okay. Cockles I never really liked. So, and I have to confess that being a Norfolk man, I don't really like crab either. So,
where did you get the winkles from?
Well, they would be bought by, again, off a, someone coming round the village. I don't know where they were. I presume they would have been probably... they probably would have come in from King's Lynn off the boats. Because when King's Lynn still has a lot of fishing...
from the Wash.
From the Wash. And I presume that's where they would have come from.
I think you still get cocklers there now.
Oh yeah, the cockle boats still go out, and yeah.
And a winkle is just a smaller kind of cockle, isn't it?
It's similar, isn't it?
That's more like a snail. I thought, and a cockle was a bit more like a mussel.
Yeah. Yes.
And where do you get your food from now?
Sainsbury's. Most of it.
So no delivery people anymore, or people coming through the village selling food out of the back of a van or anything?
No.
Any local markets here you go to?
There was a fruit and veg van until probably about 10 years ago. But we didn't really use it. There is a market after a fashion in King's Lynn. But no, we don't.
There are farm shops.
There's one at on the outskirts of King's Lynn at Knight's Hill, which we used to use a lot, didn't we?
So going back to locally here, are there any local shops that used to be in the village that have now shut then? Or were there any pubs and shops?
Yes. Well, we have one shop and post office, which is thriving and has thrived even more as a result of COVID. We still have one butcher's, which is Margaret Ellis, and their son runs it really now. But yes, I mean, at this end of the village, there was the butcher's, which is still there. There was a shop, a general store, and there was a post office, which also had a general store, which was just at the end of this road. There's now only the butchers left. At the other end of the village, there was the same, a butcher's, a general store, and a post office come general store. Only the post office one remains. There were numerous pubs, but we now have, well, there's one, would you call it a pub? I'm not sure they'd call it a pub really now. It does bed and breakfast and sort of serves breakfasts to non-residents, but it's not really a pub as it was. There are three pubs, but technically none of them are in Grimston. There's the Three Horseshoes, which is on the main road through the village at the sort of King's Lynn to Grimston Road. There is the Union Jack, which is a genuine traditional pub that doesn't serve food. And then there's another one in Congham, which is the sort of half, it's part of Grimston, if you like, really. The villages, Grimston, Potrow, Congham and Royden, are all sort of joined together. They're all separate separate, but together, if you see what I mean. And there is a pub in Congham.
What's happened to the ones that have closed completely? Have they become houses?
Private houses, yeah. Yes, they are now. One of them initially became a fish and chip restaurant, but that then, when the person who kept that retired, it just became a private house. So there isn't, yeah, they've all gone. We do now have a fish and chip van that comes round. Well, there are two actually. One comes on a Friday, doesn't it? I think. And there's another one that comes on a Wednesday and they just park up.
So they've become recent additions, have they?
Yes.
Maybe post-COVID or during
COVID. Well, we used the one fish, I mean, we've had a fish and chip van come round the village for many, many years, haven't we? Right from the time our children were small. Not necessarily the same person, but that's been quite a regular thing. And there used to be a wet fish merchant that came round regularly once a week, but I don't think they do now.
Can I ask if you've tried the Elsa Good's famous pork cheese?
I used to have that a lot.
Can you describe it?
I don't know. It's have you not seen it?
No, they told me about it.
It's basically bits of pork in the sort of jelly. And it's sort of fairly solid then, and you sort of slice it and cut it.
So like a pork pie kind of.
It's like
texture.
No, it's more
like a tureen.
No, well, I suppose it.
Pate.
It's not even as the. How would you describe it? There's a lot of. Yeah, I suppose more like haystack. That would be the nearest thing to it.
Like a luncheon meat, kind of.
Yeah, although it's there's a bigger concentration of the jelly and less of the pork, if you see what I mean, than you'd get in haystack.
And where does the cheese come into it?
I think because it's sort of in a block.
It's So no cheese in it at all?
There's no cheese in it, no.
Okay, we've established that. Okay, did you want to finish up with any dialect sort of...
Yes, I'll do a bit of dialect.
And then we're kind of almost there, Steve.
I'm going to follow up on a few of the questions that we had earlier, just about like words that you might have picked up from other people, but from different places. We're really interested in how language gets passed down through the generations. So it was really interesting that you said your mother is from Wales,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered if there was any lovely any words from Welsh that you remember that you still use or that have been passed down.
No, I don't think so. I mean, really, my mother never really used them. There are certain phrases, I suppose, that we recognise as being phrases from Pembrokeshire that we hear other people use, but it's more to do with the accent itself, I think, rather than the actual phrases. I don't know that. I can't think that Mum ever used any.
And the accent's part of your dialect as well. So
yes,
what was the,
I mean,
the
accent is. I mean, Mum still had a Welsh accent, didn't she? And it's interesting that accents can be recognisable, aren't they? I mean, going back to when I was at work, I mean, we had two particular colleagues, I remember. One, I was told that this lady was joining the staff who was Scottish. And when I met her, I said, well, you're not Scottish, you're from West Wales. And she was from Carmarthen, you see. And then another one had joined the staff, and as soon as he started talking to me, I said, so which part of Pembrokeshire are you from? Because he'd actually come from Hackney. And he said, how on earth did you know I was from Pembrokeshire? He said, I'm from Tenby. And I said, well, my mother was from Haverford West. I said, it's absolutely clear to me. So I think it's the actual accent rather than the words themselves. In a similar way, we had a new head teacher came to the school, and he'd been teaching in Buxton, and we were talking fairly early on, and he said, I can tell you've lived in Derbyshire. He said, it's the way the intonation in certain words. He said, it's a Derbyshire accent mixed in with a Norfolk accent, which must be quite a sort of difficult thing, really.
Yeah, you must have some northern vowels or something.
Mm. I think it was the sort of inflection, isn't it, of certain words and phrases and the, yeah, maybe the flatness on the. Some of it.
Why do you think you've picked that up? Do you just think?
Well, I suppose yeah. We lived amongst it for 4 years, didn't we? And Judith is from Lincoln, so there's that sort of a little bit more northern. Most of the students, I suppose, that we knew well. Quite a number of them were from the north, weren't they? Most of the students at the college were from the north, although some of our closest friends, one is from Suffolk, and she still has an East Anglian, quite a strong East Anglian accent, doesn't she? But Suffolk rather than Norfolk, and it's different. And her other friends are from the London area. And again, still have a, you know, you can tell it, can't you, that Jerry was brought up in Brixton. But yeah, so it's as I say, it's the accent rather than the actual words, in a sense. Whether it's because we were in the main, how would you put it? It's not quite true to say more educated, but more influenced by other people by moving around into different areas, so you were mixing with different people, so you tended to pick up on the way other people speak, don't you? So that maybe in some case, in order to be understood, possibly, as I say, the first time I listened to the tape of Isaac Elsegood, I've lived in the same village all my life, but I couldn't understand most of what he was saying.
It's interesting how it's changed over time. I certainly picked up things when I went to university in Leeds, and my vowels changed a little bit, and occasionally you slip back in, I don't know. It's interesting, it's like osmosis, and it's almost unconscious when you do it sometimes.
Mm. And I think, you know, we've said, I've sort of, in a sense, maybe sort of lapsed back more into a stronger accent than I had when I was working, because I don't need to think so much now, in a sense, about communicating with other people who don't actually understand what you're saying.
And back and then at the school, I was thinking about the mixture of young people there. Did you have people from young people from the Fens as well, from Cambridgeshire and Lincolnshire at all? And would
Not that many. Well, we did in the sixth form, because the sixth form people would come in from outside. But in the lower part, the 11 to 16, once it became comprehensive, all the children lived in King's Lynn, or in the sort of suburbs. It was the other two secondary schools did take children from the surrounding villages, but ours didn't. It was purely a town school. When it was a grammar school, it did take from a much wider area. It would take from the Fens as well.
They say the young people, younger generations, are the ones that kind of really progress the language and move it on. And as a teacher, were there any words that or accents that that the young people are using that you didn't know or you picked up? Or
I don't think so. I think no. I think because they were predominantly local. I mean, obviously there were children coming in to the area from outside. But no, they were predominantly living locally, so if they had an accent or a dialect, it would be something that was recognisable to me, because yeah, they were living in King's Lynn. I had lived in and around King's Lynn all my life. Yes, the changes came. We had a lot of Eastern European children coming in, and that, I think as well, that sort of made you think very carefully as well about how you communicated and how you spoke to them, because they were obviously trying to learn English, but they wanted to learn English as opposed to Norfolk. But yeah, that was a significant thing that happened.
Whenabouts was that?
I suppose probably from the early 2000s. A lot of, yeah, I was still teaching. It would be from then. It was from Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and then later from Romania, maybe Portugal, some of that, but it was mainly Eastern Europe. Some Russians as well, actually, because although Russia wasn't in the EU, King's Lynn, historically, going back hundreds of years, has a very close link with Russia, because of the port and the trade. And there's been a Russian community in King's Lynn for many, many years. So that was there. Well,
Did the school have a responsibility for teaching those children to speak English, or was that the parents have to arrange that themselves outside of your school?
No, the school would do that. If children came in speaking little or no English, they would have special help within the school. They may actually be removed from some of their other lessons in order to have extra English lessons to help them. Obviously, if they come in to the country at primary school age, and they already then had a reasonable grasp of English by the time they got to secondary school, some of them spoke English better than the locals. Pick it up very quickly.
Right, I'm going to ask you to identify some of these. These are images of things that do have many dialect words. So if you could just run through them. The first image is this one. What would you call that?
I would call it a hedgehog.
Yeah. And then one, what do you call that?
A daddy long legs.
Yep. And that.
Oh, I've got no idea what that is.
An earwig?
Oh, is it? Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Oh, now.
It's kind of a plant that.
It's the sticky
sticks.
One.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Do you know, I would have had a name for it when I was young, but I wouldn't.
Just mind your microphone.
No.
That, what's that a drop of?
Well, I would have said it was a raindrop.
Or in the morning when it's misty.
Oh, a dewdrop.
Bag of.
Other than being sweets, they look a bit like Haribos, but they're not, are they?
No. Sweets is good.
Oh, right, okay. Yes. Right, okay.
And what would you call that you get from the baker?
Well, you see, I would have called it a bread roll, but it's not. It doesn't really look like a bread roll. My immediate reaction when I saw it was it was a cob. But that's not a Norfolk expression. That's Derbyshire again, because that's in the north. That would be referred to as a cob, wouldn't it?
What makes that a cob more than a bread roll?
The shape. It's that sort of spherical shape,
yeah.
which you don't actually see that much of here. Mm. That was something else actually in the village. I forgot when I was very young. We had a bakery opposite where I lived. Just go across to Baker Rudd and get a loaf, would you please? Straight out of the oven.
What kind of loaf was it?
Unsliced. He didn't have a slicing machine, so it was all unsliced bread. I'm struggling to think whether any of it was wholemeal. Well, we never had wholemeal bread. And he used to deliver round the village as well.
What shape was it as well, this bread that you get?
What you'd now describe as a tin loaf or
batch?
Possibly. My memory is that they were all much the same. That they were all, yeah, the sort of traditional tin loaf shape. I don't recall any sort of different things. Maybe that's simply because we didn't buy them.
Yeah, who knows?
No.
Maybe he didn't make them. It was an easy shape to make.
And no, make it, no. It no, that's right. No.
What's the next one?
No, the last one.
What do you call these?
Those? Mm. They're scones.
Great.
Not scones. They're scones.
And how many are there in the picture, if you can see?
Which picture?
In the scones picture. How many scones are there? There's not one, there's not two.
There's three.
Thank you.
One, two, three.
Yeah. And if you turn it over, what's your word for these?
Those?
Mm.
They're spring onions.
Yep. And what is this? What are they doing in that picture?
Right. Well, I suppose, are they hugging?
The one's on the back of the other.
That's piggyback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think it's the last one. Yeah, what do you call this?
That's a seesaw.
Yep, perfect. Thank you. There's lots of different words. Heggy, gaily, tiddy bum. Oh, not heggy. Yeah, that's wrong. That's something else.
There is a word for a hedgehog, but I've forgotten what it is. A Norfolk word. I've never used it.
Fur's pig? No. Okay. Hob-me-dod?
No. That doesn't mean anything.
I think the purpose is just how you see them anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you need to pick a word here to finish this sentence. The food was... And then one of these words, tasty.
Really?
Yeah, okay. And then here, again, the same kind of thing. He asked me to fix it, and I was like, or I said, no way, do it yourself.
I said.
Okay, perfect.
But if I was talking broad Norfolk, I'd say I went. Mm. And then he went, and she went. I tried to tell someone once that Norfolk was the easiest language to learn because all the verbs had the same ending. Because the verb to go is I go, you go, he go. You go, we go, they go.
Yeah.
It doesn't change.
Okay, so I've got some question prompts and you just have to give me the word that first comes to mind. What do you call a room in a house for storing food?
Larder.
If you haven't eaten any food for a long time, you're bound to feel...
hungry.
What words do you use for something to eat? So, do you have any other words for the food you take for to work or to school or when you're on the move?
I used to call it a snack, but other than that, no.
What do you call a coffee you might get from a cafe with lots of milk in it? It's like a new kind of coffee.
What, latte?
Yeah, can you say that one more time?
Latte.
What?
Horrible.
Just to see, that's to, a good word to show your vowel sounds, your A.
Yes.
Oh. What's the dairy product that you spread on toast and sandwiches?
Butter.
Which word or phrase would you use to indicate a temporary break in a game when points cannot be scored?
Break.
Yeah. If you fall over in the playground, your knee might be...
grazed.
Mm-hmm. If you got covered in dirt at the playground, when you got home, you might need to get into the...
bath.
Yeah. When children are very excited, you might say they're full of... jumping around and going crazy. I'll say they're full of
life.
Life.
Energy.
Yeah. At the end of a long and tiring day, you would say you are absolutely
exhausted.
Which word would you use to mean not attending school? You were
absent.
Naughty.
Oh, you're naughty.
Mm. Or you're skipping.
Skipping truant.
Sometimes when children are being very naughty, their parents tell them someone will come and take them away. What do you call this mysterious person? When you were naughty as a child, did your grandparents or your...
bogeyman.
You grow crops and raise animals on a...
farm.
When you walk in the countryside after heavy rain, your shoes will get covered in...
mud.
Yeah. When you're driving in icy or wet weather, you must take care because the roads are...
slippery.
Which word do you use as a term of endearment, even with strangers?
Dear.
Yeah. All right, dear.
Mm.
Anything from Derbyshire?
Love. Duck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which word would you use to refer to somebody as very attractive?
Pretty.
What is your word for spreading rumours?
Gossip.
A picture not hanging straight is hanging...
on the her.
Yes. What do you call a very small piece of wood that gets stuck in your finger?
Splinter.
What would you call a person who mends shoes and boots?
Cobbler.
Yeah. That's it.
Okay.
That's the end.
Right, thank you very much, Steve.